You're listening to Country Breakfast on RN. Let's get out and about with our rural reporters. This week we get ready for race day in Devonport, joining the trainers, jockeys and stable hands as they get the horses ready for the track. There's a bit of nostalgia as an old Goonie bird, a DC-3 aircraft from World War II, takes to the skies. And we go behind the scenes with musician and farmer Ross Knight, a member of the 80s punk band The Cosmic Psychos. I love my tractor.
We'd only tour when I could, when the pruning was done, or if it was raining, or, it was too wet to drive the dozer. So it's all seasonal. It's seasonal rock and roll.
The world of a punk rock farmer, a bit later. First today, something much quieter. An archaeological dig on the banks of the Murray River in northwest Victoria.
Well, they always say with archaeology that for about every hour you spend in the field, you've probably got about 2 or 3 days worth in the lab. We're slowly taking off the surface of the soil, so we try to find an area that's still intact, so we can't see a lot of shell exposed. Then what we want to do is carefully, using trowels and brushes, get off all that sediment, and then slowly work down onto the shell midden itself. So what we try to do is to keep everything intact as much as possible, and we like to record, photograph, and take out all those shells individually so they can be analysed later on.
To the untrained eye, they just look like broken shells crushed into the ground. But for a group of archaeologists, these shell middens on the banks of the Murray River offer an insight into how Aboriginal people lived in this area near Lake Killalarane thousands of years ago. G'day, I'm Brett Worthington at Ned's Corner Station, a former sheep property in Victoria's northwest, where this team from La Trobe University is hard at work unearthing its past.
Hi, I'm Dr. Gillian Garvey from La Trobe University. What we're doing is excavating small 1 by 1 metre areas to try and understand, number one, how old the site is. So what we can see is we've got a lot of shell on the surface, and we have quite a good understanding of the temporal or the distribution of the shell. But what we're trying to do now is actually get below the surface and find material that's still intact, that hasn't been disturbed, and excavate it very slowly down so we can try and determine what people were eating in the past when they were living here along the Murray River, and also how old the site is.
So what is shell midden?
Shell midden essentially is just a rubbish dump, so it's where Aboriginal people have collected shells in the past from the river and come up onto the bank and sat down and cooked them and eaten them. So it's basically just the debris that's left behind after a meal.
So what's the early picture that you're starting to see from what you're collecting here?
What we can see is that we've got different parts of this shell midden, or what appear to be one big shell midden, but is probably lots of individual meals. So we're getting an understanding that even though this might look like a very big cultural site in itself, it probably actually consists of lots of small little cultural sites. So people have come here maybe over tens of thousands of years, or hundreds of years at least, collected shell from the sandy silt that's down in the river and come back up onto the shore to eat it in different places. So we can see in some parts of the midden, or in some of these different middens, people might just be collecting mussel shells to eat, but in other parts we can see that they're also collecting snail shells and eating them as well as part of their diet.
And have you been surprised by what your early findings are?
We're surprised by a number of things. Number one, we're surprised that we're only getting shell in the sites. We would have expected or liked to have found fish bones, especially fish ear bones, which are called otoliths. Those bones are very important because you can actually identify specific species based on the shape of those bones. And we're also finding no bird bones. So you might expect Aboriginal people, when they were sitting here, to also be collecting bird eggs and birds themselves. And we're actually finding no mammal bones. So we're finding no remains of meals of kangaroos or emus too. So it seems that people were specifically using this area to collect and cook shellfish only.
So where we are, the Murray River is just slowly making its way past us, and we've got Mallee Scrub effectively behind us. Is this a pattern that you would expect to see along the river here in this region?
Yes, you'd expect to find middens all the way along the Murray River, and some of these middens may date right up until European occupation of the area, European contact period. But you'd also expect middens to continue out into the scrub. So when you look at where the river used to go in the past, you'd expect to find middens along the old meanders, some of which are now billabongs and some of which have been not used for a long time. You'd also expect to get find middens out on the old Lynette lakes, so the old ancient lakes that were active in the past, so in the Holocene and Pleistocene, so 20,000 years ago or more, you'd expect to find shell middens around the old sand dunes.
So can you even pick up on things like how the mussels might have been cooked all those years ago?
Yeah, that's one thing you can do. And what I do want to undertake is do experiments. So looking at how they might have cooked some of these shells, because at the minute it doesn't appear that these shells are very burnt. So what we think that people are doing are actually smoking the mussel. So like you do today with mussels from the ocean, you smoke them, you don't actually put them on direct flame. And we think that's what people were doing in the past. So one thing that I would like to do is to get some modern shell and cook it and to have a look at what happens when you cook it under different types of heat and also using different vegetation types, because I suspect that people may have used some vegetation to try and smoke the mussel as well.
So you might be able to give some chefs a cooking lesson in how things were done thousands of years ago.
Yes, perhaps.
Listen to that. I can hear a rooster crowing.
Yeah, it's about the... That'd be about somewhere up there in the bush.
And the birds are tweeting.
Mm.
For most people, a day at the races means a fancy hat, a couple of glasses of champagne, and a nice pair of shoes or suit. It's not the case for stable hands, trainers and jockeys who are up and ready for work at 3 o'clock in the morning on race day. G'day, I'm Jane Ryan. And here at the Sprayton Racetrack in northwest Tasmania, where the Devonport Cup's about to be held, things are just getting underway for the real stars of the show.
What's your name?
Dean Wells.
And what do you do?
Horse trainer.
So we're down here at the racetrack. It's about 5:30 in the morning. The sun's coming up and everyone's getting ready to go. Why don't you describe what we're looking at?
Well, the lights are on. It's still quite dark. Track work's begun and everyone's getting ready for the big day.
So what goes into getting ponies ready for a day like this?
Plenty of good feed, plenty of hard work and plenty of early mornings, as you know now.
So tell me, when you get here in the morning on the day of a big race, what do you have to do to get the horses ready?
Oh, look, it's basically just a shampoo job and really all the work's done up until today, and it's in the hands of the jockeys or monkeys or whatever you want to call them.
Well, what have we got happening in the stable? Do you want to show me? Let's take a look.
What have we got here? We've got all the saddling equipment up the back. Here's where the feed room is.
Wheelie bins, buckets. What do you feed them?
Well, we've got a premix, Formula 3, which is, that's a multigrain vitamin, microspeed, oats, and we've just got loosened chaff and oat and chaff.
I think you might be feeding your horses better than I feed myself.
Well, I mean, they do say you keep your horses in the best care and yourself in the worst care, so that's just a basic common sense in racing, that's for sure.
How long have you been training for?
Well, I've been training about 6 years. I spent about 10 years in Melbourne, so looking after some nice horses in Melbourne. So, yeah, I come back home to do what I love, and this has been forgetful.
Well, let's say g'day.
He just got fed his breakfast, so he's pretty happy about it.
G'day, mate.
He might want to eat your microphone.
He does want to eat my microphone. Aren't you gorgeous? How old is being forgetful?
He's 6.
Yeah, so he's got a bit of time left in him, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's 6. He's done a very good job. He doesn't very often miss a check, so keeps the owner happy. He knows there's something going on there today with all the marquee tents and that in the middle, so he knows it's race day.
So what's your name?
Chantelle Willis. I'm an apprentice jockey for Leon Wells.
So what does being an apprentice jockey entail?
Quite a bit of hard work, long days. No, it's really good. It's a great lifestyle. You work in the morning, you have most of the day to yourself, and then come back for a couple of hours in the afternoon, and then you've got the race days, which are a real buzz. And yeah, no, it's really great. I love it.
So how long have you been an apprentice for?
Just over a year now, but I've only been race riding for about 4 months. So
only 4 months?
Yeah.
And you're riding in the cup today?
No, not that lucky, but I've got a couple today, a couple of even sort of chances, so I'm pretty happy with that.
So what was it like the first time you actually rode in a race?
Scary, I guess, a little bit. It was a bit daunting at first, but probably more exciting than scary. So, yeah, no, it was really good.
What does it feel like?
It's exhilarating, really. I don't know. It's just, it's a bit like, I guess you'd almost say like a bit of a drug, like something like, you know, you just can't get enough of it.
Yeah. Did you always want to be a jockey?
Not always. It's been a goal for me for the last probably 5-6 years. I've just been riding track work. I worked as a foreman over in WA for a year, and I've worked in everything but sort of the jockey part. So, yeah, no, that was, I guess that was my goal at the end.
And now you're here.
Yeah, I love it. It's fantastic.
What do you have to do to get ready on a race day?
Usually I just go through my gear, make sure everything's clean. I go through the fields, see if there's any scratchings, speed maps, that sort of thing. My weight, obviously, have something to eat, have a little drink, and yeah, no, that's probably my preparation.
It must be pretty uncomfortable though on the day of and the days before when you do have to get your weight right down for the race. Mm-hmm. How do you feel right now?
Pretty good. If you do it properly, you're fine. You're not really hungry, you're not thirsty, but you just do it in little bits at a time and just don't stress yourself out too much. You're usually all right.
Graham Tycoon. He was a top 2 year old last season, and he's just come back from a week off, so he's feeling pretty good.
He looks pretty relaxed.
Yeah, he's a lovely horse. One of the stable favourites, aren't you? Yeah, good boy.
Oh, hello. So what's your name?
Narelle Haywood. They call me Nelly. I start work at 3 o'clock and feed them all. And like the race ones and all that, I put them out before I come here, and then we load up and come to the track. Finish probably about 10 o'clock. Till we do all the work, boxes and waters and...
The life of a stable hand.
Yeah, very busy.
How many horses in the stables that
we've
you work
23
at?
23 in work.
And so you work them and look after them all?
Yeah, yeah.
What kind of... Is that a massive job?
Yeah, it's a busy job, but you love it, so it doesn't really matter.
And tell me about the, I guess, the nature of racehorses, because lots of people would see these massive, robust, strong horses and feel a bit frightened of them, but all the ones I've met this morning seem to be... Well, they're darlings, them.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we turn them into girls' horses, because we're around them all the time. But they're not mad. Once you get them off the grain, they're lovely animals.
So what happens when they're on the grain?
They get, because they're so grained up, they know what they're here for. But when you get them off the grain, they're lovely.
Really? They're so the grain's like the tell energy for them. Yeah, they go, right, let's go, got to use it. All this.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Well, this guy looks like he's ready to go. He is actually champing at the bit.
Yeah, he is. He's all ready for a wash.
Well, how about I'll leave you to it so you can get ready for your big day?
Okay, then. Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Stablehand Nellie Haywood ending that report from Jane Ryan on the pre-dawn preparations for race day at Devonport. Still to come on Rural Reporter, a bit of seasonal rock and roll with 80s punk band The Cosmic Psychos, and an old DC-3 takes to the skies in Tasmania's west.
A bit of nostalgia has touched down in the small regional airport of Strawn on Tasmania's west coast. It's an old DC-3 aircraft, and it's full of passengers keen to take in the sights of the western coast. G'day, I'm Tony Briscoe, and this graceful old bird has got a new lease of life as a charter airplane, under the control of Victorian pilot Alan Searle. And while the passengers are off discovering the delights of the nearby Zeehan Museum, I've clambered up into the cockpit to find out more about these planes and the people who still fly them.
Well, this particular aircraft is one of the newer ones of the DC-3 fleet. It was manufactured in 1945 and it was assigned to the Royal Australian Air Force, and they retired it probably about 20 years ago, I guess. So it was put into civil service around about the year 2000. And it's one of the lowest houred DC-3s probably in the world. It has 14,000 hours since new. another one that I fly has about 52,000 hours. So it's quite a young one in terms of use.
Sitting here, there's no computer that I can see, but there probably is there somewhere. What's it like to fly?
Oh, it's fairly basic and fairly heavy, particularly when you've got a load on. It's you've got to use a bit of muscle and so forth. But once it's in the air, it's quite normal. A little bit heavy on the controls, but otherwise okay. No, we don't have any computers or anything. We do concede to having a GPS for navigation purposes, but it certainly doesn't do anything, and there's no autopilot or anything like that. So it's all hand flying all the way.
What's it like inside for a passenger? There's not too much room when you're walking down the aisle, is there?
Well, no. It's a tailwheel aircraft, which means that once you step on board to get to your seat, you're walking uphill. But of course, once we're in the air, it's level and very comfortable. It's quite quiet in the cabin. It's a bit noisy in the cockpit, but in the cabin it's quite good. There is a very, very good leg room. One thing that customers say, this is as good as first class, the leg room that's available.
Alan, what's your history with aircraft?
Oh, well, I learnt to fly when I was a kid. I learnt to fly at Warrnambool. I did some instructing when I was young, joined the airlines, Trans-Australia Airlines, if people remember it, and I flew DC-3s first there in New Guinea with TAA. Well, 50 years later, I'm still flying DC-3s. You'd think a bloke's career would progress a little, wouldn't you?
And what about the cost of running an aircraft like this? Is it expensive?
Yes, it's not cheap. Unfortunately, we go to places where aviation fuel is as much as $3.60 a litre. We're using about 400 litres an hour. So it's not cheap in terms of running costs. And maintenance, of course, it's an old aeroplane, so it needs continual maintenance. But so long as you spend the money and do the work, it'll go on forever.
And what do the passengers say when they've had the flight with you, especially after the first time?
Oh, they love it. They just love it. They really do. In fact, we've got about 17 people on this trip, and there would be about five or six of the folk on board that have done multiple trips with us. We're all, well, let's say we're all over 50, and the aircraft is, the company's name is Air Nostalgia. I've actually, because we're all old folk flying the things, I've been trying to get them to change the name to Air Alzheimer's, but the boss doesn't think that's a very good thing.
So it's Back to the Future.
It is.
Well, in the Cosmic Psychos mythology, it's always this this bunch of musicians who farm. Would you consider yourself a musician who farms or a farmer who plays music?
I reckon I'm a really bad farmer who plays music even worse. How's that? And not very literate with me legal English either.
Ross Knight is a member of the famed and feared 1980s Australian punk band The Cosmic Psychos. Now, they're credited with influencing people like Kurt Cobain, Pearl Jam, and a host of international punk and rock bands over the decades. But Ross has another quieter life here as a farmer in Reedsdale in central Victoria. G'day, I'm Jeremy Story Carter, and I've joined Ross on the front veranda for a chat about how he mixes life as a musician with life on the farm.
Sitting out the front of the house, looking out towards the vineyard, which is probably the worst kept vineyard or the best trellised phalaris in the district.
And what else are we running on this particular farm?
Yeah, run a few beef cattle. The old man used to run sheep, but he gave them up about, I don't know, the late 60s. So cattle are a bit easier, so-called easier to maintain, especially when you've got other things. You've got to work off the property like nearly everybody else. So.
And how long's the family been on this particular farm?
I've been here since about the mid-1930s. And as I was saying before, the grandfather was only about 5 miles away and his old man was only about another 10 miles away from that. So we haven't travelled too far in the last 100 or so years.
As much as things have stayed the same, I guess, in your family, You're a little bit different in the sense that you also enjoy other pursuits. Tell us exactly what you were doing over the weekend.
Oh, yeah, well, I got a bit of a hobby going with a lovely little band called the Cosmic Psychos, and for this weekend we'll be over in Adelaide and Perth playing that big day out.
It's got to be a strange life. We're less than a couple of hours out of Melbourne, but it's fair to say there's not that many people around, and yet on the weekend you're staring over the faces of a couple of thousand people. What's it like going from one to the other?
I don't know, I've always done it, so it's not that hard really, and it's pretty easy to look into those people because they're usually laughing at us anyway, so I think we're more of a novelty act nowadays.
What about when you've come from a few days of just your ears absolutely ringing and playing in front of all these people to then just maybe sitting out here in the dozer, just basically your own thoughts to keep you company? How's that sort of transition?
Well, probably the worst part about it is that first night when you get home and it's that quiet, all you can hear is your ears ringing. Look, you might end up staying out and having a few drinks too many or staying up late, and it's all right for everyone else because they got to wake up in the morning and look at themselves in the mirror and walk around like a rock star. Well, I've got to get out of bed and go to work.
Well, you called yourself a novelty act, but I'm sorry to say that's not the case. They obviously had the documentary Blokes You Can Trust made recently, and that was that really was testament to how big an influence the Cosmic Psychos have. Are you comfortable with that, this sort of legacy, this mythology that's built up around the band?
Not really, and I guess I just wait for it all to blow over. While I'm tucked away here, out of the prying eyes of the world, I'm quite happy about it.
What's it like, though, seeing people, American musicians, talk about how you influenced, you know, Kurt Cobain or Mudhoney or Pearl Jam? I mean, these are big, big bands, and it's got to, you know, screw your mind over a little bit.
Yeah, look, it's a bit odd, but it's also, look, it's funny hearing those blokes say all that kind of stuff, because they're all my mates. You know, we just go on, carry on with a load of garbage, usually, and then I suppose we don't talk about music, we just muck about. And I think that's why we're mates. And look, I guess I don't see it as a musical influence, because if you can find a musical note in anything we've done for the last 30 years, I'll go hee for Heidi. But look, maybe if something, we've taught them how to relax, and maybe they can see what we do or what I do, and, you know, we just take the piss out of the music industry and don't give a stuff. And if that helps them relax a little bit more and makes them think, well, yeah, maybe it's not the be-all and end-all, that's the kind of influence I'd like to have on them. I love my tractor. We'd only tour when I could, when, you know, when the pruning was done, or if it was raining, or, you know, it was too wet to drive the dozer. So it's all seasonal. It's seasonal rock and roll. Has to fit in with everything else. But as you know, I mean, you can't plan anything around a farm because something always goes wrong. The weather changes, you know, every day is different. So, you know, the tours back then were 2-3 months long, and all I wanted to do was come home and watch the telly. Now when we tour, we sort of only go for a couple of weeks. But no, making it, no way. I'd rather be a successive farmer. Well, that's not going to happen. It hasn't worked out so far.
Well, it's funny because when the Psychos get talked about in music terms, the farmer aspect, it's quite exotic. It's used as quite a point of difference, but obviously a lot of farmers listening at the moment. Do you kind of scratch your head a little bit when they do really amp up the farming background that you guys have?
Yeah, I do, because I've got no idea. Unless you're on the land properly and struggling for a quid, you've really got no idea. But look, it's whatever people want to perceive farmers to be. If you're a farmer, you're a farmer, and that's it. And I don't complain about being one, and I'll do it till I break in half.
Musicians often are among the weirder types of characters you'll meet. Farmers, sometimes that can be the case too. Who's the weirder bunch to hang around with?
Oh, definitely the farmers, without a doubt, without a doubt. There's characters. It's a shame the local pub shut down because there's a lot of characters around here and a lot of people have been around here for a long time, and I think the farmers have definitely got it all over the rock and roll crowd. So, yeah, no, we've hardly ever made a cracker out of it, but, you know, what's it worth? We've done all the travel, you know, you get to see the world. You only get one chance in life, so you might as well take the most of it.
And a few free beers along the way?
Lost count at about a million.
Farmer and punk rocker Ross Knight from the Cosmic Psychos having a chat with Jeremy Story Carter at his farm at Reedsdale in central Victoria.